evening, everyone. We're moving on. I just want to say another kind of public service announcement here. I started a document that I made public here where I'm throwing some of the materials, basically, that I pull together. But that's just sort of a Google Doc where I'm dropping some of the things that I occasionally share on the page. So that's, you know, sort of different outlines. I'll drop another thing in there later this evening when we get to it. But some folks wanted to kind of glance back at some of the things that I've pulled out as supplemental there that aren't on the page. And you may remember from last time where we kind of began as prep for this next sugya was I did a few, basically two other parallel mishnayot, a colorful story about Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva from Mishnah Bechorot, which is kind of the narrative backdrop to a statement about when judges are expected to pay out of pocket for errant decisions and the ways in which mumchiyut, some kind of expertise, is the ticket to exemption for the judge. And then a Mishnah in Eduyot, which talks about batei din, courts being able to reverse the decisions of other courts, provided that those courts they are reversing are smaller in number and stature. Those are important backdrops for the question of reversal, which is going to be at the heart of the next sugya. The sugya that we're doing tonight is a little bit tricky and lengthy. It's got some tricky conceptual parts, but it's, I think, a satisfying kind of larger structure and a bunch of issues that are raised. So again, I'll take us through different pieces of it here, pause at different points, and I'll invite people to share their comments and their perspectives as we go. All right, great, fantastic. So let's begin. We're up here on the page and we're starting a new section, which is about Dinei Mamonot Machzirin. And you'll remember this is back in the Mishnah. It says that one of the differences between Dinei Mamonot and Dinei Nefashot, really the focus of our perek, at least the beginning, what's the difference between monetary and capital cases, is that Dinei Mamonot, you can return the case, overturn the case, review the case, retry the case, all kinds of verbs that we could use here, whether it will be lizchut or lechova, whether it will be to end up sort of crediting someone who was made to pay or obligating someone to pay who was rendered exempt in the initial judgment. Whereas in Dinei Nefashot, machzirin lizchut vein machzirin lechova. You can recall the case in a capital case to exonerate someone, but you cannot recall it in order to convict someone once they were let off. All right, so that general principle of Dinei Mamonot can be reversed is the subject now of our sugya, and they are going to quote that Mishnah in Bechorot that we got a brief preview of last time. So here we go. Urim Minhu. We're going to challenge our Mishnah from an equally authoritative Tanaitic text, in this case, another Mishnah. Uraminu danet adin, zikata chayav, chiyevet azakai, timeat atahor, tiheret atameh, masha asa sui, viyashalem mibeito. So as we saw last time, that Mishnah says if a judge decides a case and then favors or, you know, exempts from payment, right, or grants something to someone who should have owed money, or declares that someone owes money who really had the right to it, or declares impure that which is pure, or pure that which is impure, what is done is done. The case is, the verdict is not sort of overturned, but he will have to pay out of his own pocket to make up for his error. Okay, now let's say just a couple things about sort of the tension here. So at a 30,000 foot level, the tension is in fact kind of obvious, even if the potential responses to it might be obvious, which we'll get to in a minute. But the tension is our case in the Mishnah and Sanhedrin says, machzirin, you can undo a case that has been decided by the court. And this case says, Masha Asasui, right? Looking up here at Rashi, Alma Lohadar, right? That means it doesn't go back. It doesn't get undone. So there's a basic sort of difference in terms of the way this is described. What we don't have here is exactly how in the Mishnah and Bechorot you determine that zikah tachayav, chiyevet hazakai, like how do you know that that is the case, right? Like in other words, something went wrong here. Who gets to determine on what basis that, you know, the wrong decision was made? That's one hole we could ask about. And the other question, which we could sort of ask in reverse, is the Mishnah and Sanhedrin, when we say machzirin, when we say we're bringing the case again, retrying it, re-examining the verdict, is that because of an error? Is that because of new evidence? So there's any number of ways of actually resolving between these two Mishnayot. Like Mishnah Sanhedrin could just be new evidence, and Mishnah Bechorot could be an error, right? That is to say, Mishnah Sanhedrin could be you're dealing with questions of fact, and evidence of new evidence of facts has arisen, whereas Mishnah and Bechorot may just be like an error in knowing the law, okay, in some way. In a way, we'll get back to that later. That is one way of understanding one of the resolutions. The other thing, though, I want to just point out here before we abandon it is the possibility that the simplest difference between Mishnah Sanhedrin and Mishnah Bechorot is that Mishnah Sanhedrin is a kind of idealized picture of how a judicial system might work. That is to say, you got a whole bunch of courts. Some of them are three, some of them are 23. There's like an appellate system, all of this stuff. And we're saying you're allowed to have an appeal in a monetary case, or the court itself can sort of revisit in a way that makes sense when you're thinking about a sort of robust functioning bureaucracy of a legal system. What we may get in Mishnah Bechorot, particularly with the colorful and very kind of retail politics story of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon, is the actual amount of rabbinic power that was held, which is to say, there's no panel of three, there's no appellate court, there's just rabbis with whatever constituents give them whatever power they have, doing their best to offer judgments, and then potentially discovering that they've made an error and figuring out how they take responsibility. So there's a kind of like almost historical sociological analysis you could have, where Mishnah Sanhedrin and Mishnah Bechorot are just not speaking on the same plane. And we've talked briefly throughout how there are ways in which there's a sort of idealized vision of what the rabbinic court system looks like that may not always map onto what they can actually do on the ground. That said, our sugya will have none of that. That's not going to be a helpful answer. The assumption is these are two normative sources that must be squared. And since you can't override one with the other by saying, well, that one's just a mistake, or that's an amora, and this is a tana, there has to be sort of a practical and conceptual space for Mishnah Sanhedrin and Mishnah Bechorot each to live without mutually interfering with one another. And that's what our sugya is now going to do. Okay, so with that, let's go forward here. Raminhu danet adin zikata chayav chayevet azakai timeet atahor tiyer atatamei mashasa asui vishalemi beito. How do we square that mashasa asui with the fact that machzirin bein lizchut bein lechoba? Amar of Yosef, answer one. Lakasha, kan bemumche, kan besheino mumche. So Rav Yosef actually picks up on the Mishnah in Bechorot. All right, so back here on the Gemara, what we've got is a reflection on this line, basically, in the Mishnah. Standard way to try to figure out how you resolve a tension between two texts is to go into the texts themselves and see what else you can pull out. So since this text says, dan et adin, zikar tachayav, all of that stuff, but it's against the backdrop of misha eino mumche, someone who's not an expert. And then it goes on and says, but if he was an expert with some kind of standing, then he is exempt from paying. So that indicates the first part is not about a mumche. So going back to our text, that's Rav Yosef's whole suggestion. In the Mishnah and Sanhedrin, it's talking about an expert. An expert can revisit the verdict, whereas a non-expert cannot revisit the verdict. That may seem a little odd to you, but let's look how Rashi understands it. Bimumche, yesh bo koach lachazor. When you are an expert, you can go back and revisit your verdict. Velo matzile meimar le ba'aldin, anakita makama didach avdina. When an expert says, you know what, I don't think I assessed all the evidence right there, they can back out and the litigant doesn't have the right to say, hey, I liked your first decision better. The mumcha has the ability to deploy their expertise to question their own initial decision, and that questioning cannot be questioned by the litigant. Aval, b'she'eno mumcha, but when it is someone who is not an expert, matzi amar le, mi emar detama batra didach ikar, dilma kama ikar, uvahai hu deta'ita. When the person is not such an expert judge, then the litigant can say, who says your second thoughts are better than your first thoughts? Maybe you're making a mistake in your reevaluation of the case, not in your initial evaluation, okay? So Rav Yosef says, that's the way we can split up Sanhedrin and Bechorot. Sanhedrin is a mumche, and Bechorot is an eno mumche, okay? That's piece one. Now the Gemara is going to say, wait a minute, we're not so sure about that. Uve mumche machzirin, really? With a mumche, you're allowed to undo the case? V'hakatane im haya mumche levedin, patur mila shalem. How can you say that, Rav Yosef? If you go back to the Mishnah in Bechorot, you will see we had this rule, mashe asa asui, right? But then we said, v'im haya mumche levedin, patur mila shalem. If you were a mumche, you are exempt. But what's the implication? You're exempt, but the case still can't be reversed. That's at least how the Gemara is reading it, right? The Gemara is reading it that mashe asa asui is constant throughout this Mishnah. The only question is whether the mumche needs to pay. Okay, Rav Yosef might have read the Mishnah a little different there, but in order to understand the flow, that's what the Gemara attacks him with. Hakatane imaya mumche levedin patur mila shalem. Again, Rashi explaining here, alma mashe asa asui. Therefore, you see, the verdict must be in place. Umihu patur mila shalem, but nonetheless, he's off the hook for paying for his error. The chivan de mumchehu, since he's an expert, mazla bisha dehau gavra garam le lemite. It must have been just the bad luck of that person that caused him to make an error. But it is not negligence in a way that we should cause him to pay. Right? That's an unusual kind of logic here and is in part probably reflective of some of the strain of this rejection of Rabbi Yosef. But nonetheless, we'll say more about this later. The sugya needs to move on from Rabbi Yosef to get to the second suggestion, which is Rav Nachman, okay? So Rav Nachman says, kan sheyesh gadol hemenu bechokhma uveminyan, kan she'ein gadol hemenu bechokhma uveminyan. Totally different understanding of this tension between Sanhedrin and Bechorot, which is to say, don't follow Rav Yosef's distinction. It has nothing to do with mumche, not mumche. Everyone could be a mumche, everyone could not be a mumche, it doesn't matter. What matters is the relative stature of the court, meaning Rav Nachman invokes that Mishnah in Eduyot and says, you want to understand why there's reversal in Sanhedrin? There's reversal in Sanhedrin because the court doing the reversing is a greater court. Whereas in the Mishnah in Bechorot, the court or the person who wants to do the reversing is not a greater court. That is to say, Mashe Asa Asui is not actually a blanket statement in Bechorot. It's Mashe Asa Asui vis-a-vis the judge himself. He's not greater in number or stature than himself, so he can't reverse his own decision. And most other people wouldn't be able to reverse it. But if you had a court that was of greater stature or number, they would be able to come back and undo that verdict. Okay, so that is issue two, all right? Adin asks, why is time a factor? If we think that the first ruling is just as good as the second ruling, in Rav Yosef here we're talking about, why do we use the order of rulings as a tiebreaker I don't think we're using the order of rulings as a tiebreaker. I think we are saying that the mumchiyut, the expertise of the judge, entitles him to decide that his second look at the case is better than his first look at it. And that you can't particularly question that if that's how he comes along. That's in Rav Yosef's world, right? When I emphasize here these resolutions, part of the reasons I gave you the text in the beginning, it's sometimes hard to draw the line between when an Amora is giving an explanation that is really based on a set of values and interpretive lenses that they are being guided by, as opposed to what feels like a solid textual basis for their point. And I think, I'll come back to the Nam Muncha piece in a minute, I think we're feeling that a little bit here, in that I would say to you, Rav Yosef's Teirutz is pretty strong as a textual basis. That is to say, he's going to the Mishnah and Bechorot, he's saying that phrase is about an Eino Mumche. So I'm going to pluck that and say, that's the Okimta, and Mumche is the opposite, which I'm going to apply to Sanhedrin. When Rashi tries to play out what kind of judicial reasoning and theory of fairness would lie behind that, it feels a little weaker. But I'm not sure that Rav Yosef should be judged on the grounds of did he come up with the greatest legal theory, as opposed to did he hold the canon together. Now, so Adin, coming back, in the non-mumcha case in Rav Yosef, I think what he tries to come up with is, it's not so much time being a factor, it's a little bit like when they give the Oscar to the wrong team, right? What did that happen with? A couple of you can chat in if you remember what that was. I can't remember if it was Best Picture or whatever it was, right? Is there some element where it's like, well, you assigned that to me. Like on some level, this is some arbitrary judgment call. Like if you gave it to me, maybe you should La La Land. Thank you very Moonlight. Okay, there we go, right? Exactly. So, you know, you can imagine a claim that's sort of like, whatever, let's call the Academy non-mumchim for a minute for the purposes of our discussion. You know, they're flipping a coin, they're playing politics. What does it mean it's the best picture anyway? And maybe once you pull out the wrong envelope and make a mistake, it should be like, that's it, right? You just have to stick with that. It's some version of that, that the litigant is entitled to the verdict that they received. And unless you are an expert with some strong basis for saying, actually, I've rethought it, there's something wrong almost procedurally about taking it away from them. That's what I think, how I think Rashi's trying to give some basis to Rav Yosef. Again, if you don't think it's so strong, I'm not sure that Rav Yosef was formulating this based on legal theory as opposed to textual precedent. Okay, so we got Rav Yosef and we got Rav Nachman. All right, now we got number three. Now note, interestingly enough, we'll chat about this later, I hope at least briefly. Amar Rav Yosef, Amar Rav Nachman. When it's Amar Rabbi Ploni, that generally indicates that it does not contradict what came before. But now we get Rav Sheshet Amar, which indicates that this is in tension with what came before. That is to say, Rav Nachman and Rav Yosef, actually both of those could theoretically be true or nested in some way. Whoever is formulating Rav Sheshet Amar seems to think of this as a completely competing frame. Kan sheta'a bidvar mishnah, kan sheta'a b'shikul adat. No, there's two different kinds of error. Rav Sheshet assumes that both Mishnah Sanhedrin and Mishnah Bechorot are dealing with reversing a decision based on a determination of error. But there are two kinds of error. There are errors about fundamental precedent. Ta'a bidvar mishnah. Now, literally, in the most simple sense here, it means the Mishnah, meaning the Mishnah already paskened that. The Mishnah took a stance on that. If a judge just made a mistake and ruled against a Mishnah, that is the kind of gross error that leads to the reversal of the verdict. When we say that you can completely undo a Dine Mamonot case, Bein Lizchut, Bein Lechova in Mishnah Sanhedrin, we mean on account of an error bidvar Mishnah. However, there are other errors which are errors, but they are nonetheless errors in Shikul Adat. Even though Shikul Adat sounds like it means judgment call, right? But it's not really, because judgment call in English, we mean to, you know, represent some notion of, look, you could have seen it either way, you made a judgment call. No, this is a kind of shikula dad where there was a right and a wrong answer, but your error was not, how did you not know, you know, that that was written in the Mishnah? It's more like, we have a reasoned process that we've accepted as a settled matter of law, which you should have known. It's not as glaring as forgetting an entire Mishnah, but you should have known that that's the right way to think about it, and you picked the wrong way to think about it. And so the Mishnah in Bechorot, Masha Asasui, is that kind of error. And that kind of error, because it's an error more on the end of judgment, you do not reverse the case. You just make the judge pay, unless he is exempt as a mumche, exempt as an expert. De Amar Rav Sheshet, Amar Rav Asi, Ta'a b'dvar Mishnah chozer, Ta'a b'shikula da'at eino chozer. So we know there's the statement from elsewhere as a normative point of law. If you make an error about a dvar Mishnah, the case is undone. The verdict is undone, you go back. But if you make an error in shikula da'at, you do not undo the judgment, all right? And that basic distinction in law is being applied here as a hermeneutic to the problem of the conflict between Mishnah Sanhedrin and Mishnah Bechorot. Okay, let me just pause there for a minute. If there's any comments, questions, again, other perspectives on from our legal friends and other things that may be relevant. I'll just say, in terms of the Amar Mar Rabbi Ploni versus Rabbi Ploni Amar, it's a convention, and it's really basically kind of based in tone. The way you hear it is like, Amar Rav Sheshet, Amar Rav Nachman, Rav Sheshet Amar. Okay, that's how it's sort of meant to be read. And that's how it was conventionally understood, that that tone is indicating a distinction. Okay. Is the judge also liable for Ta'a b'dvar Mishnah Chozer, or is it just revoked? Good, let's hang on and see where that goes. Now you're starting to get to the interesting question of how much do the different factors here interplay with one another? All right, now we get an interesting sidebar of, these are lovely terms, Ta'a b'dvar Mishnah and Ta'a b'shikul adad, and I gave you a workable definition of Ta'a b'dvar Mishnah as something in the Mishnah, but what's the actual limit of that? All right, and that brings up this next discussion. Amale Ravina le Rav Ashi. So Ravina and Rav Ashi are way late. If you're keeping your eye on the dates here, Rav Yosef, Rav Nachman, and Rav Sheshet are all second, third generation Amoraim. Ravina and Rav Ashi are fifth, sixth generation. Amale Ravina le Rav Ashi. Afilu ta'a b'Rabbi Chiya v'Rabbi Yoshaya. This category of ta'a bidvar mishnah, okay? This notion of, hey, that's a part of the basic canon. Everyone's supposed to know that. How could you miss that? Does that apply not only to the Mishnah, but to Braitot curated by Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Yoshaya? These are sort of famous collections of Tannaitic materials that were not codified in the Mishnah, like we have today, the Tosefta, etc. Amar le'in, yes. Afilu b'derav u'Shmuel? What if there's a black letter law ruling by Rav and Shmuel, now moving into the Amoraic period? Amar le'in, yes. Afilu b'didi v'didach? What about you and me? What if I issue a ruling? Does that become Dvar Mishnah? Amar le, atu anan katle kane be'agma anan? What do you think we are? Reed cutters in the marsh? Better translated as, what am I? Chopped liver? That's how you say, what am I? Chopped liver in Rabbinic Aramaic, okay? Atu anan katle kane ve'agma anan. All right, basically a rhetorical way of saying, of course, it's actually quite a bold statement. And then it's very interesting, you later see Rishonim, people in the medieval period, then say this about themselves, right? It sort of never ends. At a certain point, everyone in their generation wants to say, this isn't about the Mishnah being a special text. This is about the dynamic of settled law. And law continues to be settled and made explicit throughout the generations. And there's kind of no end to that unfolding canon of authority. Okay, so that answers, at least according to them, what Dvar Mishnah might mean. might have been controversial to some of their contemporaries. I don't know. Now we want to know Hechidami Shikul Adat. Okay, but what's that category? Amar Rav Papa. Kegon Tre Tanae, O Tre Amorae, De Plige Ahadade, Velo Itmar Hilchata Lo Kemar, Velo Kemar. The Ikre, the Avad Kechad Minayu, the Sugya De Shmata, or Sugya De Alma, Azle Keidach. Hainu Shikul Adat. So what is this? You have two Tanaim, or two Amoraim, that is to say two people of equal authority who have an argument with one another, but no one ever pronounced that the halakha followed one of them or the other. It was just left, okay? It was left as a debate, not like Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel, where then someone comes along and says halakha ke Beit Hillel. But like so many debates in halakha, where it's like, yeah, this one says this one, that one says that one, it doesn't ever get resolved. And then something happens and the judge follows one of those views. And here's this really interesting phrase, sugya dishmata azle ke'idach. So Rashi has sugya de alma over here, which means the way of the world, basically. Sugya from sage, to walk in Aramaic, and from our word for sugya, which is just a mahalach, a process. A thought logical process going through the Gemara. He translates it as, in a real life way, Rov hadayanin nirim lahem divrei asheni. It was never really resolved, but most people, right? So this is the kind of thing you hear a lot of times in discourses around halakha, that yeah, most people don't eat tablet K cheese, right? Sentences like that. It's like, what does that mean? Whoever said that? Whoever pronounced? Where is that written in any book? But it's some appeal to there being some consensus that has emerged or is emerging. That is a ta'ut in a shikul adat. That is to say, I can't nail you on precedent. I can't nail you as an ignoramus. But I can say you have departed from the consensus, and that is not your prerogative to do that. That is an error, okay? Sugya de shmata, so sugya de alma sounds like it's sort of the world or in general. Sugya de shmata might connote something else, which will be appealed to by various poskim, which is literally the sort of flow of the oral tradition, which is to say, do you get a feel from the Talmud or from the discussion which way they were leaning? This will be important by the end. This is a self-referential point in the sugya. That is to say, sometimes you have a sugya that doesn't formally say, most sugyot don't formally say the hilchata ke, right? They don't resolve it. And yet sometimes you can sort of feel they're going after one position again and again and trying to shoot it down. And even if they don't shoot it down, they only save it with sort of the most outrageous deflections. Sometimes poskim will say, come on, anyone with eyes to see knows which way we're supposed to be favoring here, even if a ruling was not issued, all right? So those are our definitions of Dvar Mishnah and Shikul Adat that flesh out what it would look like to apply Rav Sheshet's rubric here, okay? Great, a couple of questions. Who initiates the appeal process when there's another judge involved in the reversal? Not clear. And this goes to the question of how much are we dealing with a functioning system or bureaucracy in any kind of a way. That's where, again, I come back to, I think the simplest explanation here on some level in terms of just what the sources are actually talking about is Mishnah Bechorot is telling you how it really went, which is there's no one to appeal to. The only thing you can do is hold the judge accountable. And Mishnah Sanhedrin is imagining how it ideally would work. And I think in that ideal envisioned process, there's all kinds of hierarchies. There really are. I mean, you find like the Sifrei Dvarim, Shoftim v'Shotrim, Titen Lecha v'Chol She'arecha, talks about like every region has a court and there's a high court, and very much the way we think about district, circuit, and supreme. When you're talking about how would you actually apply this, you would either need some kind of hierarchy like that, which sometimes, you know, Jewish communities developed, like the Va'ad Arba Aratzot, you know, sort of a very important Polish council of rabbis that tried to create a certain hegemony over the people in its midst in early modernity. And other places in Spain, there seems to have been something like that. But I don't think it's so clear. It's a little bit messy in terms of what's going on. And yeah, in terms of the judge's accountability, we'll get to this in a minute, Susan's comment. I'll hold it till we see a little more colorful detail here. That's definitely part of the tension of how and when are we holding the judge accountable? And the Mumche piece seems to be addressing that. That is to say, depending on how high you set the bar for a Mumche Levet Din, it either is a very special privilege, or it's a way of really saying, we're not going to penalize you unless you have no business really judging the case in the first place. Let's go forward here. So, Etive Rav Hamnuna l'Rav Sheshe. So now you got to imagine, and I'll show you a graphic representation of this in a bit, just like put aside all of that Ravina, Rav Ashi, and Rav Papa stuff. We're now going back. Rav Sheshet gave us this way of resolving Sanhedrin and Bechorot, and Rav Hamnuna is now going to come attack him. And he's going to attack him from the next part in the Mishnah in Bechorot. Okay? So, Etive Rav Hamnuna l'Rav Sheshet. Ma'aseh b'para shel Beit Menachem shenitla ha'em shela ve'echila Rabbi Tarfon l'klavim. Uva ma'aseh lifnei chachamim b'yavne v'hitirua she'amar todos ha'rofe ein para v'chazira yotzeit me'alexandria shel Mitzrayim ela im ken chotchin ha'em shela kedei shelo teled. Amar Rabbi Tarfon, halcha chamorcha Tarfon, amar lo Rabbi Akiva paturata. Shekol ha'mumche l'rabim patur mi'lashalem. This is the Mishnah we saw last time. Case of a cow, it had its uterus removed. Rabbi Tarfon was asked to judge whether that was a trefa, whether that was no longer an animal that could be eaten because it basically had a terminal condition. And he ordered it, and seems from the interpretation later, it was carried out to be fed to the dogs. This is not something that a Jew can eat, so it had to be fed to the dogs. The case came before the Chachamim in Yavna, and they said, what are you talking about? No problem, an animal without a uterus, because Todos HaRofe testified that in Alexandria in Egypt, they didn't let any animal out of the country, in particular a cow or a pig, that did not have its uterus removed, so that their sort of secret breeds would not be shared and smuggled out. Rabbi Tarfon, realizing that that means that animals live perfectly fine and well for years without their uterus, says, well, that's it, my donkey's gone, because I'm obligated to pay for my mistaken decision. And Rabbi Akiva says, no, you're a mumche, you don't have to pay. So what's the challenge? The iita, if Rav Sheshet's distinction is correct, if Rav Sheshet is right, that in a case of toe bidvar mishnah, the case, the decision is undone, lemale toe bidvar mishnah ata, v'toe bidvar mishnah chozer. Why did he give him a speech about you're a mumche? He should have said whether or not you're a mumche, this was an invalid decision, because this was ta'ut bidvar mishnah. Now, how was it ta'ut bidvar mishnah? Rashi over here. Toe bidvar mishnah ata, stam mishnahi be'elu trefot. It is an unattributed mishnah. And here that is being invoked to say, undisputed in the third chapter of Chulin, nitla ha'em shalak shera. There's an actual Mishnah in Chulin that says, if the uterus of an animal is removed, it remains kasher. So this is just an outrageously wrong ruling, and therefore he should have said to him, to'e bidvar mishnah. The fact that he didn't say that indicates that he does not think that that is a way out. Right? In other words, the fact that he has to go to the mumche exemption indicates, argues Rav Hamnuna, that Rabbi Akiva did not think that ta'ut bidvar mishnah is a basis for undoing the case. All right. Side point, who knows that Mishnah in Chulin actually predates Rabbi Tarfon. Right? In other words, maybe it is the codification of this story based on Rabbi Akiva, but here, Rav Hamnuna already takes that Mishnah to be canon and assumes it is something older than Rabbi Tarfon that he was expected to know about, and he blew it. So how does the Gemara answer that? Chada ve'od ka'amar. No. He was saying two things. Chada d'to'e bidvar mishnata, v'to'e bidvar mishna chozer, ve'od inami b'shikwa l'da'a ta'ita mumche l'rabi mata. V'chol ha-mumcha le-rabim patur mi-le-shalem. Meaning, Rabbi Akiva had in his back pocket that this was a ta'ut bidvar mishnah, but wanted to use the opportunity to say, but you know, furthermore, even if it had been a case of ta'ut b'shikul adat, I want you to understand you would have been off the hook anyway. Okay? So Rav Hamnuna raises the challenge from that text, and then we deflect it by saying, chada ve'od, there's more here than meets the eye. It's not by invoking the mumcha exemption. Rabbi Akiva did not mean to deny or suppress the ta'ut bidvar mishnah basis for reversal as well. In which case, Rav Sheshet's, you know, distinction between Mishnah Sanhedrin and Mishnah Bechorot can stand. Okay, one more link here in this piece. Second order. Amar Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak le Rava. Mai kam motiv Rav Hamnuna le Rav Sheshet mi para. Para harei ha'achila laklavim veleta detedar. So this is a question on how did Rav Hamnuna have the nerve to ask this question of Rav Sheshet? What kind of crazy question is that? The case of para, he fed it to the dogs. There's no way of undoing that case. Meaning the whole basis of the question was he should have told him, you're toeh bidvar mishnah, and that goes back. But he couldn't have said that to him because there's nothing to go back here. He can't undo the judgment that the cow should be fed to the dogs once the cow was already fed to the dogs. Note, the assumption here is that ve'he'echila does not mean he decreed that it should be fed. It's that he'echila means it was fed, which seems like it's the simplest sense of it, given that Rabbi Tarfon thinks he's going to lose his donkey, which probably you would only do if the owner had already suffered a loss. So we got a second order question here of Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak's asking Rava, I do not understand what Rav Hamnuna is doing here, okay? To which the answer is a little convoluted. Hachika amar lei, and this might be Rava responding to Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, or it might just be the Talmud finishing in what was an unfinished discussion. Hachika amar lei. No. This is what Rav Hamnuna was saying to Rav Sheshet. I amrat bishlama ta'a bidvar mishnah eino chozer al makamdina hainu deka mafchid Rabbi Tarfon veka amar le ihu mumche leveitinata ve'ata patur mila shalem. Rav Hamnuna was saying, look, if you held that a ta'ut bidvar mishnah, a gross error in missing an explicit precedent, is not a basis for undoing the judgment, well then, the judgment would have stood here, because despite it being a ta'ut bidvar mishnah, it would stand. And then I would understand why Rabbi Tarfon would have been afraid. He would have been afraid, oh my God, that decision's not going to be reversed, and I'm now going to have to pay. And Rabbi Akiva then answered him, no, you're a mumche levetin, and you are exempt from paying. Ela'i amrat ta'a bidvar mishnah chozer. But if it's as you say, Rav Sheshet, challenges Rav Hamnuna, that when you err in a matter of dvar mishnah, the case is reversed, le'male kevan de'ilu havai para, dinach lav dina velo klum avadata, hashtanami lo klum avadata. If you hold that ta'ut bidvar mishnah is chozer, then Rabbi Akiva should have said to him, hey, you don't have to worry. If the cow were still here, this would be an invalid decision, and you just would have given back the cow. So too, you've done nothing here. It's an invalid decision. That is to say, the decision is so invalid that actually the litigant can't claim to hold you accountable for it, okay? You were stupid. Everyone was stupid for following this through because it was a completely ridiculous decision, sort of top to bottom, okay? Let's just look at Rashi on this to sort of help flesh this out, because this is definitely a sort of strong whiplash swing to the other side. Hachi ka amar le Rav Hamnuna I amrat bishlama. This is now the rereading of Rav Hamnuna to make him a reasonable challenge to Rav Sheshet, even though the cow is gone. Alma kamdina, klomar masha hora, hora, the inami ita kaman lo hadra mitachshira. Okay, so the verdict would have stood, okay, meaning what he had, what would be done is done. And even if the cow had been here, we wouldn't have sent it back. That's sort of how Rav Hamnuna is saying, that would make perfect sense that Rabbi Akiva would then say, the only way I can get you off is because you're a mumche l'rabim. Okay, but in the case of lav klum avadata, that is to say what Rav Hamnuna is saying, right, it should have been, is de'ihu hu de'afsid anafshe shehishlicha laklavim. The litigant destroyed his own cow by agreeing to throw it to the dogs, given how outrageously wrong your decision was. Ve'at lo afsaret le'midi b'may de'paskat ala shem trefot, deha ibayit le'medar hadrat. Because if he had wanted to challenge and reverse the decision, he could have had it immediately reversed. So the fact that he gave up and allowed your outrageous decision to stand makes it his fault. Okay, huge problems here in terms of thinking about this actually being played out in real life. Essentially, it assumes that the litigant has pretty high degree of expertise and sort of accountability for the judge's failings. But again, this is sort of what Rava is trying, or the Gemara is trying to do to uphold Rav Hamnuna's challenge. So yeah, your incredulousness of like, how can it be his fault? Here too, I think we have some tension between how people are trying to tie together various principles that they hold and various texts that they need to pull together. And you try to weave them into a completely coherent theory of law, they may not always totally hold together. But this response, particularly if it's on the part of the Gemara, is someone later on doing their best to hold those different threads together. Okay, if you don't like that, you can be bailed out here now by Rav Chista. Rav Chista Amar, again, a debate, a contrary way of looking at this. Rav Chista Amar, nope, there's a different distinction between Bechorot and Sanhedrin. Remember those two Mishnayot? If you lost them, that's what we were talking about, right? Bechorot and Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin allows for a reversal. Bechorot does not. What's the difference? Kan shenatal v'natan bayad, kan shelo natal v'natan bayad. The distinction is whether the judge actively took something from one of the parties and gave it to the other party. This is probably a leaning into the language of zika et hechayav, chiyev et hazakai. That is to say, the judge here actively took a step to give something to one of the parties, took it away from one of the parties and gave it to the other. Rav Chista says, in a case where the judge actively did that, what's done is done. It does not say why, but plausibly, there's some sort of legitimacy to the judicial act that's got to be maintained. If the judge actually seized something and gave it to the other person, you cannot then take it back. The most you can do is force the judge to pay out of pocket to make that person right, but you don't reverse it. That's Mishnah Bechorot, Natal v'Natan Bayad. Whereas the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, with its more liberal regime of reversing the verdict and the decision, is Shelo Natal v'Natan Bayad. There was just a judicial order given, but the litigants applied on their own. The litigants applied it, right? The judgment complied with it on their own. It did not need to be enforced by the judge. In that case, you can simply undo it, right? Rashi's formulation here at the bottom, tziva leva'aldin vehu oseh me'atzmo. Then, machzir hamamon mizeh shekiblo lezeh shenetano. All right? So in that case, where there's self, you know, voluntary compliance, it gets undone. That's the case of the ta'ut in Bechorot. But in a case where the judge actually does it, then you have Masha'asa Asui and the only discussions about compensation. All right, now we got to just tie up the loose ends of, does that really work? And we're going to do a sort of convoluted failed understanding first, and then Ravina is going to come and save the day here to try to make it simpler. Okay, so now the Gemara says, Bishlama. Well, okay, I can buy that explanation in a case of Chiyevet HaZakai, or I can understand what you're talking about in Chiyevet HaZakai. What does Chiyevet HaZakai mean? There was someone who was in the right, like they didn't really owe anything. And the judge says, you owe money. And they took it from that person and gave it to the other. Great, I understand. Bishlama chiyevet hazakai in Bechorot, that's kegon shenatal v'natan bayad. But zika et hechayav, heichi mishakachat la. But how are you going to get natal v'natan bayad with the other case in Mishnah Bechorot, where you say someone who really owed money doesn't have to pay? That is to say, that seems very obviously a case where the judge is passive. So if you're going to say the whole field of application of Mishnah Bechorot is a case of natal v'natan bayad, how are you going to apply that to the second clause? So what do we say? De'amar le patur ata. The judge says you are exempt. That is to say, there's a declaration of the person's exemption. Gemara asks the obvious question, v'halo natal v'natan bayad, but you didn't actually seize the asset. Yeah, kevan de'amar patur ata kemoshe natal v'natan bayad dami. No, the judicial order saying, right, I find for the defendant here is effectively like taking money away from the plaintiff and putting it in the defendant's pocket, even though it's just the inability to collect. All right, so we can therefore say those are all those, all cases of natal v'natan bayad. But now that's going to boomerang because well, ela matnitin de katane, dine mamonot machzirim, bein l'schut, bein l'chova. But wait a minute. But our Mishnah said, you can undo a mamonot case, whether it is for zechut or for chova, which means whether it is to give someone basically back money that, you know, they, it turns out, you know, should be theirs, but you took away from them. Or l'chova is to charge someone, right, to tell someone that they are obligated to pay something that you earlier told them they're not. Bishlama lizchut mishakachat la, I get how we're going to have a case of, you know, reevaluating the case lizchut, de amar le meikara chayavata velo natal venatan bayad. Given that we're trying to understand the Mishnah and Sanhedrin as a case where the judge did not actually take money from one party to the other, so I get how we could reverse a Dine Mamonot case in that way when you first say, hey, you're obligated to pay, you didn't actually enforce it, and then you go back and say, actually, no, you're off the hook. We didn't expect it. That makes sense. That can happen without natal v'natan bayad. Ella lechova hechi mishakachat la. But how will you ever reevaluate a Dine Mamonot case, lechova, where you want the judge to be totally passive, because that only, the only case where it seems like you could do that is the amar le patur, where the initial verdict was, yeah, you don't have to pay anything. And now you want to go back and say, actually, you do have to pay anything. Veha amarta, but you already said, kevan da amar le paturata, kemosha natal venatan v'yad dami. If you want to say in Mishnah Bechorot, in order to make all the phrases add up and be consistent, that just the declaration that you're exempt is like the judge forcibly taking money from one party to another, well, then that case is also forcibly doing something in the Sanhedrin case. But when you say that you're allowed to be machzir lechova, what could that possibly mean other than you declared someone exempt from payment, and now we're going back and saying they have to pay, okay? So you tried to make it work there. It's boomeranging here. Okay, now a desperate Hail Mary pass to save this. Chada katane. It's not actually two cases. That is to say, Mishnah Sanhedrin sounds like machzirin, bein l'zchut, bein l'chova. You can reevaluate a monetary case in a lo natal velo venatan bayad context, whether to get someone off the hook or to now require someone to pay. That's not what it means. It's actually one phrase, chada katane. And how should you read it? Dine mamonot machzirin lizchut shehi chova. You can reevaluate a monetary case in order to help out someone lizchut, to basically exempt them from a payment that you obligated them in your initial verdict, which zechut, once decided, is of course a chova to the other side. That is to say, the only case that the Mishnah and Sanhedrin is talking about is actually reopening a case to get someone off of paying. But you can actually reopen a case to get them to pay, because whenever you declare someone exempt, it is kemi shenatal v'natan bayad, and that's where Masha Asa Asui controls. And what do we mean? Dine mamonot machzirin l'zchut shehi chova. Because remember, what's the phrase in the Mishnah? Dine mamonot machzirin bein l'zchut bein l'chova. Dine nefashot machzirin l'zchut ve'ein machzirin l'chova. So they got to be parallel. So how should we read the whole Mishnah? Dine mamonot machzirin only l'zchut, which is a chova to the other side. Dechavata, whereas in the parallel case, gabei nefashot, in capital cases, machzirin lizechut, you can return to exonerate someone, but ve'ein machzirin lechova. Machzirin lizechut, zechut gredita, ve'ein machzirin lechova, lizechut shehichova. In capital cases, unlike monetary cases, you cannot return, you cannot undo a case in order to exonerate someone or for the benefit of one party, if it is going to be to the detriment of another party. Meaning, in dine mamonot, you can reevaluate a case. This is all in Rav Chista, right? You can reevaluate a case in either only in the direction of getting someone off the hook for money that you told them they had to pay. But you can do that even though it will, of course, be bad for the other party. Whereas in dine nefashot, you cannot reopen a case for one person for their benefit if it will be bad for another person. Well, now the Gemara asks an obvious case. Chovatei deman. What do you mean? What kind of capital case, when you exonerate the defendant, is there going to be something bad for someone else? Halakashya chovatei de goel hadam. There's a blood redeemer. There's a relative. There's the people who showed up to the sentencing who, if you now undo the verdict of the person who was convicted, well, it's helping the person who was convicted, but it's terrible for the relatives who wanted this guy executed. That sounds emotionally sensible, but the Gemara immediately then says, Mishum chovatei de goel adam katlinan leila hai? What are you out of your mind? You're going to actually execute someone who you now think is innocent because it's going to upset the relatives? Ve'od, and this is sort of, Yehuda ve'od lekra, for those who know that reference, sort of where you bury the lead. Ve'od, my bain bain. But the bigger problem here with this whole mahalach is the formulation in our Mishnah and Sanhedrin was dine mamonot machzirin bein lizchut bein lechova. Those are obviously two separate cases, not a zechut shehi chova, etc., etc. Kashya. So this whole thing melts down. This whole way of understanding what happened in terms of how did Rav Chista apply Masha Natal v'Natan Bayad, and we were trying to make Mishnah Sanhedrin a whole other crazy case, and it's the judge pronouncing that you're off is like Natal v'Natan Bayad. None of that works. Ravina swoops in. Ravina Amar, no. There's a much simpler way of understanding this, a much simpler way of explaining Rav Chista. And here you see, right, the Ravina Amar. That is to say, he's disagreeing with the whole process of the Gemara that we went through. How should we understand Mishnah Bechorot as a case of Kegon Shenatal V'Natan Bayad, that the judge was active? So in Zika et HaChayav, that's easy, right? In Zika et HaChayav, so what he actually did was he told someone, Chiyevet HaZakai is easy, right? That's the judge seized it from someone who it shouldn't have been seized from. Masha asah asui v'yishalemi beto. How about Zika et HaChayav? How can you get a case of Zika et HaChayav to be the judge being active? Ravina Amar, Kegon shehayalo biyado mashkon unitalo minenu. Ah, so what do you have? There's a borrower, or a purported borrower, someone who left a security deposit with his lender. And the judge decides that actually the borrower paid off the loan, and therefore the lender has no basis holding the security deposit anymore. And he seized the security deposit and gave it back to the loveh, gave it back to the borrower. That can then be a case of, you can revisit that and say, oh, he was zika et hachayav. Evidence comes to light that the borrower did not pay back the loan. Nonetheless, he got his security deposit back. Zika et hachayav, masha sa'asui v'yishalemi beito. And a question you might have been wondering, how can timei et hatahor and tihera et hatamei ever be something of masha asa asui? What do you mean? Like, he issued a ruling, so undo it. Meaning, what do you mean? If I said to you this meat is kosher, and then later I come back and say it's treif, what's done is done, right? That's it? You get to rely on that? Says Ravina, timei et hatahor de'age be sheretz. Here we get maybe a little flavor of how rabbis sometimes had to enforce their judgments. Timei et hatahor, they're imagining the judge might have said, yeah, I'm declaring this tamei, and just to show you how final this is, I'm going to touch it to a mouse. In other words, I'm going to make this final. There's no way you're getting out of this. And then what's done is done, in the sense that there's no going back, right? The object has then been rendered impure. And tihera tatamei she'ervan ben peirotav. Guy shows up with an apple and says, hey, I'm not sure if this apple is actually tahor. And the judge says, absolutely, and I'm going to show you how I stand by it. I'm mixing it into the rest of your apples. And then later realizes, oh my God, it was tamei. And then basically what's done is done, because there's no way to undo the facts at that point. The fruit, the produce has become tamei, or the tum'ah has been lost. And so therefore you've got to only rely on the question of payment. This is a kind of complicated sugya, and then I want to invite any comments and thoughts on this. I'll just show you also here, I made an outline, and I'll throw this in that document that shows you, I think, in a very interesting way. Sometimes I find it very helpful to do a kind of outlining with sort of indenting in ways that they would have relied on all kinds of oral cues to sort of memorize this and keep it in order. When you learn it from a written text, you sometimes have to find ways to sort of reconstitute that sense of what is parenthetical, right? The way you speak with parentheses is you lower your voice or you take on a different tone of voice. The way you have to do stuff like this in print is a little bit different. And here, what I've just shown you, which you could easily lose, is that the fundamental skeleton of the sugya is, we've got a challenge from Mishnah Bechorot that is coming to our Mishnah in Sanhedrin. And then you've just got really four suggestions: Rav Yosef, Rav Nachman, Rav Sheshet, and then Rav Chista. They're all in the second, third generation. They're speaking with each other. They've got four different ways of understanding this. In the middle, you've got all kinds of first commentary from much later Amoraim, what counts as Dvar Mishnah, what counts as Shikul Hadat, okay? You've then got people in the fourth generation who are challenging Rav Sheshet, responding on his behalf, trying to figure out how solid a response that is. And then you've got Ravina again in the fifth, sixth generation, indented here on Rav Chisda, not a sort of alternate opinion, but something that is meant to stabilize and kind of end that discussion in a way that is tenable, where all of this is basically filler between Rav Chisda and Ravina of an alternate formulation, which if we were doing a deeper dive on the sugya, more sort of thorough analysis, you might ask, how did that get in there? Why did that get in there? What is that adding beyond Ravina? One of the interesting things, the last thing I'll say on procedure, and then just open up if there's a couple comments, the history of halakha of the sugya is interesting, because you remember we had that phrase in here of Rav Papa, sugya deshmata, the notion that there's a certain flow of the way the discussion goes. So if I was to ask you, what is the conclusion of this sugya? Because this is an interpretive question, but it also has ramifications for when can you reopen cases or not? And this is a kind of classic sugya that does not give an answer in terms of who the halakha is like. So all kinds of people have to then chime in later and say, here's, I think it goes this way, that way. And one of the claims is, like the Rif, for instance, makes this claim. Well, the halakha is definitely like Rav Chisda because that's where the sugya ends up. That is to say, the sugya's choice, as it were, to put Rav Chisda last is something that, for a number of people, is understood to be indicative of where the normative flow actually goes here. Okay, kind of elaborate. It's a sort of a fun sugya. It took most of our time just to get it, and as opposed to I like to have a little more interspersed sort of reflection on what it more broadly means. We might have a little time at the beginning of next time. Any quick comments or questions on sort of the broader issues that have been raised here? Adin, you want to articulate your question or a thought coming out of it?
So it seems when we make a distinction between Tabet Val Mishnah or Tabet Val Shikul Adat, we're saying that if you make the more gross mistake, then you're not liable. You just reverse it. Whereas if you make the more subtle mistake as a judge, you become liable. Isn't that a bit surprising? That with a less gross mistake, you are more liable?
Yeah. So I'll say two things about that. One is just to sort of retread something I said before, where I think the basic theory there is that the litigant is sort of, it is legitimate for the litigant not to have a decision in his favor reversed. There's some, I think there's a notion of anyone who talks about this, is there's some legitimacy, again, to having gotten the Oscar, right? Even if only by mistake. And therefore, to the extent that it's anything less than a gross error, which truth be told, right, in that case, that is a ta'ut bidvar mishnah, right, in the Oscar case. It's like they literally took the wrong envelope, right? So in that case, fine. There we have to undo it. But that otherwise, basically, it's not so much about incentivizing or disincentivizing the judge. I think the seat of it is it fair to the litigant to take away that point? Now, the other thing I think we don't know here is how much later is that happening, right? If enough time elapses, and again, the lawyers may be able to speak to this, like a person already has sort of like used that money or planned on that money or sort of factored the way they go through the world already based on that decision. If it happens 5 minutes later, that's one thing. But what happens if it happens much later? And truth be told, again, not from an actual procedural point of view, but when you're not thinking about the death penalty, but you're sort of thinking about life imprisonment, et cetera, what are the consequences of reversing a judgment, you know, a month after it happens in a, you know, imprisoned for life kind of case, as opposed to like 30 years later, right? There are different emotional consequences, right, to what that means. And I think there may be some grappling with that in some way. So yeah, I think the key there is really figuring that out. Yeah, Beth, can you say a word about estoppel?
Basically, estoppel is when you change a position or you rely on a certain determination and change your position based upon it. And it's sort of an equitable principle. Someone else posted a detrimental reliance is similar. It's really an equitable position when you where you've changed your position based on the circumstances.
And what is the, if it can, I'm sure it's complex, but to the extent there's any kind of rules or guidelines, like how do you calculate that? Or does time play a factor? Or who makes that judgment call?
Time absolutely plays a factor. So the longer the time that's elapsed and the actions that you've taken during that time, I think that'll have a tremendous significance.
Mm-hmm. Great. And as I said, you know, I think the part of the complicated thing here is coming back to what I think is really the pshat of the Mishnah and Bechorot, but even if you read it the way the Gemara reads, they're dealing there with a sort of messy reality of how do you exercise authority and power simultaneously to trying to get buy-in from people to empower you, right? In other words, these are not judges that actually have the force of the state behind them in any kind of a way that frees judges, right, in all kinds of ways when you have that power, in bad cases to be arbitrary, but in good cases just to sort of be functionaries of a system. But this is really, you know, think more like the rabbi of a shul, where there is real authority, there's power, there might even be written into the bylaws certain things that like the rabbi can do and is actually empowered to do, but the rabbi is also hireable and fireable by the board. And there may be some terms about what the ritual committee does or doesn't have some kind of authority over also. And that's not entirely simple, right, to figure out how you navigate that. And that I think is some of the piece of some of what's happening here. All right, terrific. Thanks for sticking around just a little on a shifted schedule. We will be back next week at 8 o'clock, and I anticipate we'll be remaining at that time until I tell you otherwise. Have a great rest of the week. Pleasure.